There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show this week, the Super Bowl was big this year, really big, but not big enough to beat an economic crisis. We look at the problems at Paramount. Also on the programme, Channel 4 pushes back against Richard Osman's analysis of the troubled broadcaster. But who's right, or more right, our panel debate. All that plus we celebrate the life and work of Steve Wright. Find out why Piers Morgan is off to YouTube. Check out the differing fortunes of rival newspapers. And in the media quiz, divine what's really happening behind the scenes. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, more details are emerging as a result of Channel 4's restructure. Broadcast reports that head of youth Carl Warner and Caroline Hollick, head of drama, are set to leave. And despite having shared leadership, the new drama and film teams will remain independent. Viewers in Poland were witness to an apology from the state broadcaster TVP on Sunday. This was for the years of shameful words directed to LGBTQ plus people, as the channel sought to distance itself from a very close relationship with the former governing party. And BBC Sound claimed a record 5 million listeners using the app in a two-week period at the end of last month. They say the growth came from live listening and new podcasts, including The Traitors Uncloaked. Now, joining me at the London Podcast Studios, we welcome back someone who was managing editor of Radio 1 in the 90s, did strategy for the BBC, ran Disney in Europe, and now a kids media globetrotter. It's Paul Robertson. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Nice to be back.
How are you?
I'm good. Have been globetrotting a little bit. I went to India, which was interesting. I was invited by the Indian government to go and talk about animation. Mm-hmm. They think I know something about it. I know a little bit. So nice trip. Went to Delhi. And there was one thing about the building, though. This is in the building where Modi holds all of his big events. There was no Wi-Fi. Because they designed it in such a way that it just could not accommodate routers. So there was no Wi-Fi. So you go.
Was that lovely, actually?
It was sort of lovely and terrible, because I know there's people trying to reach me and I had no idea what was going on.
So are they interested in production, building out skills, or obviously it's a huge market as well?
Yeah, there's about 500 animation studios in India, and the Indian animation market for domestic is quite healthy, but what a lot of them can't do is hit the different standards for international. So they're all trying to export internationally, because that's where the money is. And so they're trying to learn how to produce global hits rather than just local hits.
And also joining us is someone who's just come back from their own globetrotting, but more from an enjoyable basis.
Yes.
Come back from skiing. It's journalist Scott Byrne. Hi, Scott.
Hi, lovely to be here. You're right.
I'm very good. Are you more parallel turns or snowplow?
I think that normally I don't actually turn my skis. I just sort of go down. And my friends who I've always been on holiday with said, this was the first time that we went skiing that we weren't perpetually worried about your welfare. Like, you're actually managing to now do subtle turns and stuff.
That's good.
So, yeah, happy for myself and the progress.
Something you both got a connection to, we both kind of talked about this week, is the sad death of Steve Wright. Huge outpouring of kind of support and kind of interest in Steve. And he's someone who's sort of been in people's lives for the last 40 years, hasn't he, Paul?
He has. It was extraordinary looking at the front pages of all the nationals. Practically every national newspaper had a picture of Steve Wright on the front. And I can't think of many people who get front covers and haven't done anything bad.
Yes.
And there it was. I mean, I worked with him at Radio 1 and I was sort of very privileged to do that, I guess. I mean, in two ways. I was sort of technically his boss, although Steve didn't really need a boss. He's an incredibly hardworking guy. You know, he was doing 2 till 5 on Radio 1 for about 19, 20 years. And he'd come in at 9 o'clock. with his McDonald's breakfast and sit down. But he worked. He was a real worker. I mean, he was fantastically engaged with the audience. He sort of understood what the audience wanted. You know, he was great with his guests. He managed to bring almost all the production staff into the show. I mean, he invited me in to do voices. And of course I said, yes, I'll do voices for Steve Wright in the afternoon and be one of his afternoon boys. Although you couldn't be afternoon boys now, I guess. You have to be afternoon boys and girls. I think you admire him for his creativity, his hard work, his sheer ability to survive in a world that changes. You know, then 23 years on Radio 2, Jim Moyer really was the guy who got him back, having, you know, fallen out and did the breakfast show on Radio 1, didn't really work out. And, you know, together he and I worked on that strategy, which was to put Jonathan Ross on Saturdays, Steve Wright on Sundays to reinvent Radio 2. And, of course, the rest was history. And Steve, you know, I remember Steve saying to me after about a year, he said, thank you for that. He said, I've got my leverage back. and he did afternoons on Radio 2 very successfully.
He was a strange person. And this has come out in some of the obituaries, incredibly focused on production and audiences, could be quite mercurial as well, and sometimes that's helpful in trying to stay in media, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I found him quite difficult to persuade and influence. You know, you had to influence. You couldn't tell. You had to persuade him. And, you know, he would listen, but he was, you know, he had very strong views, and that was part of his strength. He was also very shy, of course. You know, great in front of a microphone, but didn't really like doing the Radio 1 Roadshow. Mm. Not really. Didn't really work on television or Top of the Pops. He had his own studio at Wogan House, Radio 2, with curtains around it. So you couldn't look into the studio when he was on the air, because he was sort of creating this world of all these characters and stuff. And he wanted just to be, you know, intimate with the microphone, as it were, and talk to the audience and not be distracted by all the stuff around. And that was part of his strength. So I think a sad loss. He went out, obviously, literally on air on Sunday and then died, you know, literally 48 hours later. So I guess that's probably how he wanted to go, because he devoted his life to his radio show.
He did. Scott?
I mean, I would say that there was just something so inclusive about him. Like the fact that, okay, you are on Radio 2, so obviously you are having a broad listenership. But it was the fact that he just allowed anybody in. I was so taken just by the range of tributes that were, and just how it crossed so many different generations earlier this week. I think it also caused, I mean, when you listen to radio, you sort of think about the times in which you were listening to it when I was younger. And I remember listening to this in my parents, when my dad was taking me to the swimming pool when I was 8. And I think he sort of feels that when somebody like that, who's been a part of your life for many years, passes away, you sort of feel like you're losing the connection to your past as well. It is so, so sad. And I think there's just something about his ability to connect with people, despite the fact that he was quite a private person. You didn't really know much about about his life and his sheer kind of way of communicating with the audience. I mean, specifically going and remembering that it's, you're only speaking to one person, not a mass amount of people. It is. I mean, that's the thing. I think it was also noticeable that Greg James, who of course is the Radio 1 host and for breakfast, he played Steve Wright's theme on Wednesday morning, the following morning. And of course, Greg James is a geek. He loves radio. Mm. But I would feel that actually to his audience. I think that they were feeling that loss too. It wasn't just for Greg's benefit. I think it was also for the listeners.
And also, it's that thing in we talk a lot about audiences splintering and becoming kind of smaller. He's sort of one of the last truly mass media operators. Oddly, like, I wouldn't really put Steve Wright in a pantheon of anything to particularly talk about, but when you talk about those front pages and the kinds of response, because he had that connection over so many years and on the radio, which is a great medium that people make part of their lives. Mm. It's sort of fascinating that he's one that manage that.
It is. I mean, if you look at the audience figures, they were very, very broad. I mean, he was still bringing in older audiences and younger audiences too. He really had a, you know, in the going back to the old days of maybe ILR, when it had a very broad audience, Steve Wright was really that, rather than it being segmented to a younger audience. Just before coming here, I bumped into Bob Shannon. We had a cup of coffee in the same place, and he was saying how he felt...
He used to be a controller radio too, as a big BBC boss.
And, you know, he was saying how he generally felt he'd lost a member of the family. You know, it was a grieving. And I think very few people could probably have that sort of impact on so many people. And a lot of people were inspired and influenced by him. I mean, he himself, of course, you know, borrowed from American Zoo formats. He borrowed a bit from Kenny Everett, but he created his own thing. And the other thing you have to say is he was an absolute ratings magnet. When he came on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Radio 1, the ratings went up, and he did the same thing on Radio 2. He was very popular, yet he didn't win many awards. It's funny, at the awards, you know, the Sony Radio Awards, I remember having this conversation, people didn't really want to vote for him. It's funny, I think maybe now they might change their view.
Yes, and David Lloyd, I saw speak, I think, on Times Radio, and he was saying, you know, there is a unique skill in being able to do the day-to-day really well every day, and not suddenly be, you know, the world's most innovative broadcaster, but someone that can choose basically the same records every day in a different order, in a different way, is a real skill that we don't necessarily think about.
But also having that, that long-term plan as well, like sticking around for it. I think some people still think that radio is a stepping stone to TV, and therefore you'll be in it for a couple of years. You can tell Steve, you know, with Steve, like, radio was him through and through. Like, he didn't really have that much TV involvement. Would do Top of the Pops.
He didn't like TV, he didn't like it, and he thought it actually, he didn't really want to be photographed. You know, he wanted to create this image. He didn't want to be, you know, be seen. I mean, 3 hours a day, you know, long time. The other person I would compare him to, different genre, different type of joke altogether, is Roger Scott, who did 4 hours a day, and he was the same. He didn't want TV. He wants to be, you know, a radio presenter who talked to the audience and related to the audience. And Steve and him and Roger, in many ways, are very similar in their philosophy.
We're talking about someone with sort of a real strong presence with audiences. Jon Stewart returned to The Daily Show this week, the comedy news show in America. He's just doing a single day. Scott, did you see his first show?
I did. I mean, Jon Stewart is like the gold standard of late night satire. So the fact that he was able to get back into it with such ease was initially a shock, but then it was a bit like, oh wait, hang on, he did this for so many years and he invented this sort of late night form. I mean, the ratings were really good. I think the most viewed for that program for 5 years. Also, Paramount used to be very adverse to putting things on the internet. Now they actually put the whole thing on straight away, and that has, I think, on had a look on YouTube, had about more than 6 million viewers. So it seems to have a bit of a connection. I think he's a bit of an anomaly, though, when it comes to late night satire. I mean, I think there's been a 60% drop in the ratings for late night TV shows in the US. I think streamers have really struggled to try to do a show that reflects the news. I think just because the mentality of once it's on Netflix, it's on forever, whilst cable and late night TV shows over here can reflect on the following last week or the last day. So I can see why he's only doing it once a week. It's interesting. I think a bit like Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, it's just focusing on the last week. Perhaps there isn't that daily need now for a show. I think it's less of a daily show, more of a weekly show now, to be honest.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see whether he can sort of drag it back to being, you know, of real interest with audiences. He's also become executive producer of it and is sort of leading a sort of creative renewal as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was reading, I was seeing some graphs the other week about how much there has been a decline in the Daily Show viewership. Of course, that's coming at a time when in the US many people are cutting cable. So it's really about whether you're able to have a singular consistent voice beyond Jon Stewart, perhaps for Next Generation. I think their show has been guilty of something that I think so many shows are guilty of at the moment, which is having rotating hosts. I think it weakens the show because you're not able to get the consistency. And when you're wanting someone to reflect on the news of the day, you want to be, oh, you know, what is this person's point of view? You don't want to have to sort of turn on the TV and just say, oh, who is it this time?
I mean, Paul, John didn't need to go back. He's made a few quid. He can sort of do what he likes. He had somewhat free reign at Apple until he felt he didn't have enough. Do you think he's come back because he's got something to say rather than wanting the bank account filled?
He probably is missing it, I imagine. You know, he has got things to say. He wants to share them. I think he probably is enjoying it. I do agree exactly what you're saying, and that is, you know, it's about the relationship with the individual. You know, it's not a news show where the host is immaterial. It's actually about him. And if you like him, it's like liking a columnist in a paper, isn't it? You want to read what that person's got to say. And we're interested in what he has to say. And he's come back and he's proven he's still got things to say. So good on him.
We're talking about viewers. A big news story about the Super Bowl's audience figures. 123.4 million viewers. The numbers are always slightly complex and they change over time. So there was a line about this being like the highest number since the moon landing.
Yeah.
Which I think perhaps maybe true.
But it's always the case of when they always say, since records began, and then you look and then you go to yourself, well, when did records begin? And of course, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, it was impossible to really easily track how many people were watching. I mean, like, this is the thing. There was a lot of obsession about this. Obviously, it hit a high benchmark in the US. But for a big sporting occasion, it does not reflect accurately really where TV is now, which is going through a difficulty, particularly in the US, of large cutbacks. Paramount announcing cutbacks in the last week. CBS News announcing the same network as who aired the Super Bowl, announcing cutbacks the following day. And then in the same case with like the UK, most watched, I think in the top 10, you had the Queen's funeral from just over a year ago. But of course, we have seen linear TV viewing changes. So I think it shows to me that when it does matter, when people do sort of find that the TV is necessary to turn to, they turn to it in a big way.
Paul, I mean, Scott's right. Is it an anomaly, or does it actually show the direction that linear TV needs to take? Does it have to be big live events because streamers and others have stolen other formats?
No, I think I agree with Scott. I mean, roughly 50% of viewing now is to non-linear in the US, and the other 50 is cable plus broadcast. But the Super Bowl is, you know, it's hard to understate how big the Super Bowl is. And I think there is still this sense of this is one time when everyone comes together. And because it's only available on broadcast networks, everyone gravitates to it. And I do think there's still that need, that human need for sort of shared moments, big moments, whether it's the Queen's funeral or it's the Super Bowl. I mean, there were some other factors, I guess. There's obviously the issue that they're now measuring mobile out-of-home viewing for the first time, which may have helped a bit. There's the fact it was actually a pretty good match and was very needle, 25-23, so it was close. And Taylor Swift is probably also...
helps, doesn't it?
Helps a bit, you know. But I think fundamentally, I think I agree with Scott. I mean, when people want to come together, they do come together. You know, everything is very fragmented. And this is something that in the US is a phenomenon. You cannot underestimate how big it is. You know, I was talking about it to some US colleagues and I said, oh, why is the number so big? And they said, you're joking. You don't know why? I'm thinking, well, I don't really, but let me try and work it out. It's just, you know, it's so in the DNA. It's a, you know, it's a must.
Scott, as you said, CBS's parent company, Paramount Global, lose 800 staff, about 3% of its workforce, according to The Guardian. Is this economy? Is this Paramount underperforming? Is this the world?
I mean, I think it's a combination, as in most things at the moment being a combination of factors. I think there's a lack of consumer confidence in terms of taking out subscriptions. There's been rumours that Paramount might be eaten up perhaps by HBO and... on the other one now. They're all merging into one in my head.
There's an independent group have maybe come together to buy Paramount.
Yes.
Warner Brothers Discovery.
HBO. It's like, at the moment, it's like trying to map in my head of who owns who at the moment. But yeah, so I think at the moment, like, you want to have a very tight ship in order to be attractive, to be bought. But I think there's also just a sense at the moment, I mean, each week is so depressing at the moment because each week starts with another round of media layoffs.
And Paramount have sort of missed out on the boom that other streamers have had, haven't they? They haven't really managed to do it.
Well, they came late. I think their launch was pretty good. You know, I mean, they you know, started with Yellowstone and the Star Trek franchise and all of that. So I think they had a pretty good start, but they have got problems that they can't launch in all the European markets because the rights are tied up with Sky and with others. And so they can't do that until those rights expire. You could be right. It could be that they are getting themselves ready to be bought, or it could be defensive. It could be, in fact, that they don't want to be bought. Warner Brothers Discovery have got massive debt. They overpaid. And just servicing that debt alone is an eye-watering sum every month. Paramount might want to remain independent. I think, you know, for any content producer, you actually want Paramount to remain independent because the more buyers there are, the better it is for the production community. So I'm hoping, in fact, Paramount do not get bought by Warner Brothers Discovery. The other thing they have said, of course, is Maria Kiriakou was fired, you know, sensationally, walked into her office and the following evening she left and it was announced on the Monday, you know, the president of International. I know Maria very well, of course, from her Disney and ITV days. And they've said they're going to focus on Hollywood hits. So they're going to spend...
Which is nice to say, hard to do.
Hard to do. But I mean, what it really says is we're going to spend less on content. We don't think we need to spend as much to maintain our base. You see Disney, you know, the latest report, you know, their subscribers went down by over 1 million, but their total revenue went up on the back of the price hike, which was expected. So, you know, you're seeing a repositioning here. You know, we're not just about having as much content as we want. We're going to optimize the amount of content, and we're going to maybe accept a smaller base, but we're going to focus on the financials, the bottom line.
Well, speaking of a change, news this week that Piers Morgan is to come off Talk TV's broadcast channel and move the show exclusively to YouTube. I mean, Scott, that is the end of linear Talk TV if your main star's off.
I mean, it's a heck of a PR spin they've done.
Oh, they had a real good go.
The line that they've said is, now by going onto YouTube, we've unshackled ourselves from linear TV. My sense is that there was no real audience there to begin with. I have been following this for some time, just because I've been intrigued by whether opinionated TV can really take hold in this country. And I think it's been in freefall for Piers Morgan on Censor since it began. It started with about 300,000 viewers. By April 2023, an episode received 22,000, which is a fall of 95%. And then in that July, an episode of Jacob Rees-Mogg on GB News had 100,000, whilst Piers Morgan had only 14,000. And then in September last year, a midnight repeat of Nigel Farage on GB News had more than Piers had. So yes, he is getting particularly long form interviews quite well on YouTube. I did a bit of a research in 14 million with Andrew Tate, 6 million with Ronaldo, about 500,000 for Rishi Sunak.
I mean, if you hear me look at that and you'd go, well, maybe I should just be on YouTube then.
But I mean, it's just the fact that if you look at how many of those hits compared to the actual rest of the videos, it's not really stacking up. I mean, and I guess he can say, right, I'll just forget a lot of the other nonsense I used to do in the show and focus on maybe doing one big story and trying to land it and maybe not having a daily release cycle, which you would be tied to with a daily release. But I still don't think this is them saying this is a win. I still think this has been a massive, massive financial failure for them. And I also think that it puts the rest of Talk TV up for, you know, they've managed to change the whole station to be very much focused as being a sort of live streaming TV channel. I think the ratings have not really broken through, and that's cost them a considerable amount of money.
And affected Talk Radio as well.
Because I was in a cab the other week and the guy was listening to Talk Radio. But of course, all the branding, all the words you hear from the DJs are all saying, you're watching Talk TV. And I keep thinking to myself, this is a radio station. This is so confusing. It just has a brand, it's confusing. So there's been a lot of reporting, I think, Adam Sherwin in The Eye saying earlier this week that there's rumours about, speculation about maybe it will be rebranded to Sun TV. But I mean, it's been a costly, costly, costly investment.
I mean, there's been some discussion that apparently Rupert Murdoch has been talking to GB News about whether there's an acquisition or a combination. I mean, GB News does what it does well for that audience. And figures okay, you know, they're still low.
I mean, they've never been able to match what they had for their opening night. Rishi Sunak still had about 100,000, but on a daily basis, it's still not high.
But it's still definitely a build on what Talk TV's doing. And Paul, do they only need 100,000, you know, big right wing fans, and they want to be an influence network? It's the people behind it rather than it being a broadcast project.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's about the goals, isn't it? You know, if you want to make a business that's going to make a big financial return, it's probably not the business to be in. Whatever you think of GB News, the difference is GB News does stand for something. You know what GB News is, love it or hate it. I think Talk TV, you don't really know what it stands for. And there are plenty of other places to go. As far as Piers Morgan is concerned, you know, he's about making sure his name is out there. I mean, Piers Morgan is brilliant, isn't he, at seeding a story, and it's about Piers being controversial and saying something.
And he's a good broadcaster.
Hmm. And look, YouTube is the second biggest social platform in this country. 44 million people use YouTube. So in terms of reach, him reaching people, YouTube's a great place for him. So for Piers Morgan, it's a tick. For Talk TV, probably death.
Speaking of GB News, you may have seen last week that Ofcom have cleared host Neil Oliver of complaints. Scott, Jay Martin had an interesting take in The Guardian this week. Did you see what she said?
I mean, this is the whole thing about the GB News basically having this story by Neil Oliver that was kind of casually mentioning quote-unquote turbo cancer being linked to vaccines, and then Ofcom coming back and say, well, you know, this is someone's personal point of view. We're not going to actually launch an investigation about it. And I think what's so telling is, what's so shocking is, like, it's making you go, okay, well, what does breach your rules? What does launch an investigation? And I think Jane's article sort of points out about, it's a bit obtuse. It seems to be the only case that the Ofcom know for themselves exactly what does break the rules and what could potentially not break the rules. And it's very much like GB News itself is really just seeing where the line is itself and trying to push that as much as it physically can.
I mean, Paul, like me, you've had to look at the broadcasting codes over the last few years, over the last 20 years, and try and...
At least.
And try and navigate through them and sometimes push them. I mean, I read some of these things and I'm surprised what they're managing to sort of get away with. And this is the difference between kind of news and kind of current affairs content. And basically, if you're not news content, you can sort of get away with much more.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult, isn't it? I mean, no one's going to argue for reducing free speech in this country. Of course not. You know, the fact we have such strong journalism is actually a great strength of this country. However, I was surprised because I thought, hang on a second. What about people who might have lost loved ones here? You know, what about the fact that this might discourage people from taking vaccinations? And indeed, to the piece you mentioned earlier, I mean, apparently it's had an impact on measles inoculations. You know, fewer kids are being inoculated, which is clearly very bad. So I was surprised. I mean, I don't want to criticise Ofcom, but there have been one or two strange decisions by Ofcom recently, not just this one, you know, the BBC local radio one and various others. I just wonder a little bit about the leadership there at the moment. I mean, I hope the regulator is doing its job, but this one, I was a bit surprised.
Is this for Ofcom the challenge of dealing with a multimedia world? Like, when it was a regulator that basically regulated probably the main five channels, and then a bit of cable and satellite, but it didn't really cause them much trouble, fixed number of radio channels, didn't have to worry about the internet, that actually was pretty manageable. Plus, your news broadcasters in the UK, ITN, Sky, BBC, pretty much is good and fine and doesn't drift into any of this. Have they just suddenly woken up to a new nightmare?
Well, it's certainly more complex, and there are many, many more outlets, and it is more difficult to monitor, let alone to decide. I mean, we know, don't we, from radio days, that in fact Ofcom's view was, we'll wait until someone complains. Now, you know, in this case, there are only 70 complaints. So maybe Ofcom thought, therefore, it was not a particularly significant one. I'm surprised by the ruling. I think they maybe should go back and look at this again. I personally do not agree with the ruling.
Scott, it's kind of interesting that, you know, GB News is the home of Tory MPs who are often presenters. And Rishi Sunak appeared on GB News on Monday in a by-election week, the sort of thing which Ofcom Electoral Commission didn't normally used to like. I mean, partly they've been embraced. They are the establishment, aren't they?
I mean, this is the whole sort of thing when I think GB News originally set themselves up being like, you know, we're the anti-establishment. We get to say what really is happening. And then you've got Boris Johnson joining you. So you're sort of thinking, oh, how can you still have that sort of messaging? And I think it's going to be fascinating as we enter the election year, because, of course, there are real rules. And this is when we're going to be, I guess, having more of a focus on Ofcom guidelines again about having... potentially, you know, a lot of your own GB News presenters not being able to be on your own broadcast for weeks, for months, potentially, whilst the channel was still trying to position itself as an election channel. Now, I think where the channel does have strengths is perhaps attracting audiences that don't really watch BBC, don't really watch Sky, particularly in the north. But you're wondering about whether... I mean, you know, firstly, what will happen if, you know, it is seen to be taking the side more towards Tory views during an election period, and how will it be able to navigate that? Or is it just going to see where the rules are and see where the line is and try to get as close to the line as possible?
And worry about that later. Thanks, Scott. We'll be back with more media news after this.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday's the anniversary of Jarvis Cocker's stage invasion of Michael Jackson's performance at the Brits.
Then on Tuesday, we tell the story of the Spaniard who named Florida,
On Wednesday, the birth of instant photography, the Polaroid camera.
Thursday was the day Dolly became the world's most famous sheep.
And on Friday, the foiled 19th century plot to kill the entire British cabinet.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. Scott and Paul are back for some more news in brief. Last week, Richard Osman, on some other podcast, laid out his reasons for the crisis at Channel 4. And this week, Chief Exec Alex Mann responded in The Guardian. Scott, what did she say?
So, I mean, it's firstly to say what Richard said. I mean, Richard said that that Channel 4 does many great things and has done many great things, but it hasn't really had anything that's been a big hit for a while. I mean, it's relying on old successes such as Taskmaster, which was essentially bought from Dave from Bake Off, which was before Ian Katz, because that was under old management. So there's been a lack of new hits coming through. He does mention the piano, but there's been nothing since. And he says that there is a law of diminishing returns. If you're not having a new hit, then people aren't going to stick around for the other shows, and then those won't be hits, and then that will mean that people won't stick around for the other shows. So he says that Channel 4 is in real trouble. Now, Alex Mahon has said, well, you know, actually we are having big hits. The Piano's been a big hit. Big Boys has been a big hit. There's also been, I think, the Russell Brand investigation by Dispatches last year. But I mean, personally speaking, I mean, I'm looking at the TV market as just a reviewer, and I'm thinking, well, how many shows am I getting really excited by on Channel 4? I mean, if you look at the start of this year, I have on my phone just a guide of like all the TV shows I absolutely loved. And I've had, you know, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office on there on ITV. I've had Criminal Record and Apple TV Plus on there. I've had The Traitors on BBC on there. So far, no Channel 4 show has been there. They have done good programs. There was a Miners' Strike documentary I've seen. Big Boys has come back on series two, but no blowout hit that everyone's been talking about. And I think I am leaning towards what Rich is saying. I'm getting worried.
Paul, I mean, I always feel like we're giving Channel 4 a bit of a kick in every week on the show at the moment. They've had a tough time. They've changed a lot of how they run. There's a lot of things happening all around the country, a lot of good things, but it just seems to be stuck in a bit of a rut.
Well, I think as well as what Scott said, which I do agree with, there's also the issue about the advertising market, which has turned down. And ITV are feeling this too, of course. And they've also got this challenge of transforming to become a digital broadcaster. And I was talking to someone this week about ITV, and the problem there with ITVX is that ITVX is getting really good engagement, but it's not yet making really good money. And of course, every impact...
Is that ad supply or not enough audience to...
Lower CPMs.
Okay.
Lower CPMs on the digital service.
The amount
of
money the advertisers are paying...
Less per impact.
Yeah.
So ITV want to obviously move people across to ITVX, but every impact that moves across, they actually lose money on. So of course, that's going to discourage them from moving people to ITVX. Mm. But ITVX is clearly their future. Mm. So you see the dilemma. So, but ITV have got more scale. I mean, ITV control the display advertising market in the UK. Channel 4 is a much smaller beast, much smaller revenue, but they've still got the cost of running a 24/7 TV operation, and they're meant to be this commissioner broadcaster. So it's more complex, and they don't have their own production. Mm. And obviously ITV make a lot of money now from ITV Studios, and ITV Studios is contributing more and more to the total revenue on ITV. Channel 4 don't have that. So they've got this sort of double bind of they're not getting hits coming through, which might be their commissioning process, or might just be there's nothing new being made. And they've also got declining advertising revenue. So it's very, very difficult. I mean, Alex Mann does take a bit of a swipe and says, oh, the independent production community is going to be damaged. I would say to her, one thing you could do about that is actually spend more money domestically and less money on third-party acquisitions. There's a lot of shows on Channel 4, which are also on Netflix, and they're paying a very, very healthy license fee to acquire, you know, shows like The Big Bang Theory, Modern Family, and so on. They don't need to be on Channel 4. Mm. Why not spend that money on UK independent production?
And they can draw down more cash. They've got sort of like an overdraft facility that they haven't chosen to do. Obviously, they get the chance now to go into production, change the rules for Channel 4. They can make their own things. That will obviously scare the production community because they like the fact they get 100% of the material. How should they embark on that? Should they buy something? Should they build something themselves? What should their production outfit be?
I would be going shopping. I mean, the way ITV have built it up is largely by acquisition. You know, they've been acquiring over a period of time, and they've built up, you know, a series of, I mean, ITV Productions is really a whole bunch of independents that have been bought and acquired. I think Channel 4 should do the same thing. Look at some of their key suppliers, and they could have taken a minority interest initially, couldn't they, which might give them a favoured commissioning structure. But no, I'd be building up my own independent production base. And look, there's a big market outside the UK. You know, you work in the kids business. You know that you cannot make money from a kids TV show just in the UK. That's increasingly becoming the case too in other genres. So if they can sell Channel 4 content overseas, that would make a massive difference to their bottom line.
Let's finish this week with a few quick press stories. The Spectator's editor, Fraser Nelson, has warned against selling his magazine to foreign nationals, saying that Redbird IMI, that's the people that have seemingly acquired The Telegraph and The Spectator, the sale to them would have a profound impact on UK media. The government's still deciding whether they should be allowed to. Scott, is that a sort of warning letter to the government? Are the sort of established journalists trying to spook the deal?
I mean, it is fascinating just seeing this all play out in public, I think. I mean, I was like a few weeks ago, I was in WH Smith and I just saw the front page of the Daily Telegraph, and there was a front page story about essentially itself on the front page. And, you know, The Spectator with Fraser Nelson talking so openly about this. I mean, there's implications there for the reader. Because they would be thinking, oh, you know, they would be, I think Daily Telegraph readers, Spectator readers are very loyal, would be very loyal. But if, of course, what's been said is that senior journalists would leave or would no longer have anything to do with it, that would possibly spook them. And then, of course, would make the Daily Telegraph less of an attractive outlet to begin with. Now, of course, Jeff Zucker has said that with The Telegraph, you know, it would be independent, they would have a panel, advisory boards, so forth. But I mean, it's just a fact, of course, this has been going on and on and on for weeks, and this won't be the last time you'll be talking about this on this podcast.
But also, Paul, media has been controlled by strange groups of people forever, hasn't it? Why do you think that the sort of senior Telegraph bods are kind of drawing a line and saying, most of which have worked for Murdoch Media, most of which have worked other places too, why are they going, no, we don't want them?
I don't know. I mean, I've worked for some of those strange people too. And were we worried when Sky made Channel 5's news? I don't think we were. I don't think anyone was scared or you know, the horses didn't bolt. So why are we worried on this occasion? I think it's a non-story. I've no idea why this particular media property should be treated like this. It's business as usual, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, Scott, one argument that newspapers have always sort of shied away from is sort of being critical of their funders and also other proprietors. It's sort of an immerter over all of that. Press Gazette made the connection to Peter Oborne's resignation for The Telegraph, who he claimed had remained silent over HSBC criticism when they were a big advertiser. I mean, does this just sort of play into it's fine when it suits you?
I mean, there is always going to be, I think, essentially a bit of a conflict of interest of no matter who owns you in regards to other media properties, that you're not going to have criticism of those other media properties. I think that sort of goes without saying. I think it's another different thing of if you are tied to a company that has many different interests and many different companies, because, of course, if that company is embroiled in a very big issue and it's somehow not being reported on by your own papers, then that raises questions about our democracy and about whether the right stories and the right people are being challenged. I think it's just this ongoing issue. It's not one that I think is entirely new. I think if you look at Private Eye, the amount of times it's pointed out that a certain company has not been written about by a certain newspaper because a certain person who owns it might have certain mates or certain business interests in that. This has been a long-standing issue in British media ownership.
Radio broadcasters too. And The Guardian and Mail have both published financial updates this week. Paul, it didn't look like a great result for The Guardian.
No, not good at all. Revenue down, debt bad. I mean, the only bright spot was the digital revenues up by 3 million, so a pretty small percentage, but at least it's up. Really the same issue as we mentioned just now with ITV and Channel 4. Transformation for The Guardian is proving to be challenging and time-consuming.
And Scott, the Mail has fared a little better despite the ad downturn. Why do we think that is?
It's mostly, they say, I think it's been offset from events, primarily in the United Arab Emirates, doing fairly well. I mean, I think it's...
You think they'd be supportive of these acquisitions of the Telegraph then?
But it's the case that, of course, in the last few years that a lot of media companies had sort of felt, well, the future's in events and investing a lot of events. And then, of course, the pandemic happened and that was the thing that nobody could actually go and do. And I think, of course, with the consequence of many of us working from home, which is, being a freelancer, may I say, I am in support of, I think that has had a knock-on impact about the potential about media companies investing in events in themselves over here. But, I mean, it seems to be doing better internationally.
Okay, just enough time for the media quiz. This week, entitled Definitely Maybe. A few new media projects have been announced this week, or have they? You tell me if the stories reported are definitely true or maybe true and dependent on official confirmation. So buzz in with your names if you know the answer. So Scott, you'll say...
Scott.
And Paul, you'll Paul. Say...
Paul.
Let's play Definitely Maybe. Question number one. Netflix is to release its dramatisation of the Prince Andrew Newsnight interview in April.
Scott.
Yes. Definitely or maybe?
Well, it's definitely because we've seen it. I mean, we've seen the Gillian Anderson trying to imitate Emily Maitlis.
Looks great.
Have you seen it? I have, yeah.
Billy Piper in there as well. Rufus Sewell is in it too. I mean, this is the thing. Like, it is based on the book. I have not read it from one of the producers. I think, one of the sort of key people that helped set up the interview in the first place. And, of course, it was a big coup. I guess there's a big question of, is there going to be enough material to make this blowout?
Yeah,
the interview itself was blowout, but it's like, what else is there to tell us?
I mean, Paul, some people have sort of argued, you can just watch the interview. It's on the internet. Do you need to see a drama about it?
I mean, I think it's extraordinary that Gillian Anderson is playing Emily Maitlis. I mean, a Hollywood actress is playing a BBC journalist. I mean, it's fantastic. No, I thought the clip was great. Mm. I look forward to seeing the whole thing. I think it's just got an energy about it. I really think it's just stands on its own.
I mean, I will reserve my judgment to say, I never like sort of like, adding, saying, oh, it's going to be rubbish. It's been like, I always try to wait until I see it.
When you watch it, I think you might like it.
No, when are you going to get previews?
When's it out again? It's quite soon, isn't it?
Yeah.
They filmed it because we've seen it. Yeah. So, it shouldn't be that long.
Okay. Question number two. Okay, definitely or maybe, Gavin and Stacey is to return with a special at Christmas.
Definitely happening.
Oh.
I hear it's definitely happening. Wow. Is it not?
Well, like many people...
I mean, I'm very well connected to James Corden, you know.
Well, many people have said that it's definitely happening. But maybe it's moved into the maybe column because Ruth Jones was on RTE this week. Sort of saying, where do these people come from?
So
Was she denying it?
From my understanding is deadlines... I know that deadline sourcing, I know the people who wrote the story well, and they say that their sourcing is very good with their original story. They're saying that Gavin and Stacey's coming back. I think they really do think it's happening, and could they say that it's going to be very likely. I think Deadline also would have to be fairly confident in publishing that story in the first place. Ruth has said, well, if we had something to announce, James and I would announce it. But if you also watch the interview, she doesn't categorically deny it of the possibility of it happening.
And I guess the BBC do need something for Christmas. I mean, you know, Mrs. Brown's Boys ain't happening, is not working, thank God. Gavin and Stacey is a guaranteed banker, and BBC do love to own Christmas.
But there is, well, a new Wallace and Gromit this Christmas as well.
Okay.
They have spent a few years on. Aardman have been sort of doing big projects for Netflix in recent years. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, like Gavin and Stacey had
slightly different audiences.
Yes, and of course, Gavin and Stacey had 17.5 yeah, million. So the BBC would be thrilled.
Yeah, so all right.
Okay,
let's see.
But the BBC's not denied it either. It's not commented. So
maybe you do get a point, Paul.
I have half a point, or maybe
at least, at least.
Or maybe we have half each.
Okay, well, let's see who answers this one.
Give me points.
Question number three. Boom Radio's launched a new station called
Definitely,
Boom Rock.
Paul, definitely.
Yes, it is definitely. I mean, Boom Radio's done great. We've talked about it a bit on the show. 3 years old, a reach of nearly three quarters of a million, or over three quarters of a million. They've added a light station, they've added a rock station. It's the right thing for them to do, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, there's some evidence their reach has started to level off in terms of growth. So they now need to give it another sort of kick, I think. And the rock station is great because, I mean, if you listen to Boom Radio, they've done a really good job in mixing together music. But there are times when you think, well, I'd rather not hear that maybe 50s record and hear something with a bit more guitar. Mm. So Nicky Horn has been very much part of this. And, you know, I declare an interest here. You know, I listened to Your Mother Wouldn't Like It on Capital. You know, I worked with Nicky at Radio 1. I worked with Nicky at Talk Radio. He knows his music and he's been very involved in the choices, and I have listened and it's been a very well crafted mix of music. I mean, and he's bringing back Your Mother on Saturday afternoons, and Roger Day's doing a show on there, and a guy from Radio Trent called Gary Burton, that's the one, he's on there. So I think this is going to be good. I mean, how much it was going to add, I suspect it will add more hours than reach. I think it will definitely grow their hours, add a bit to their reach, but so far I'm impressed, and good on Boom. Yes,
well, Boom's done a good job generally, you know, from the ground up, put the money where the mouth is, grown an audience, and I hear it's doing pretty well financially as well. They were somewhat shocked last week when the BBC announced that they were going to launch their own similar spin-off station to Radio 2. I won't say the word that Phil Riley sent me in a DM when he heard about it. He was pretty annoyed. He's right to be annoyed.
He is right to be annoyed. The BBC have abandoned that audience and moved Radio 2 younger. I think it won't be the same as Boom. I mean, it will have to be distinctive in terms of content. So it will include a lot of archive material, a lot of sessions, a lot of interviews. It won't be DJs playing records. But nevertheless, it's targeting an audience that otherwise the BBC appeared to show no interest in. So I don't think it's going to kill Boom off. It probably will hamper its growth. And it does feel a bit like public money being used to distort the market. The issue, I think, is that the public interest test, as I understand it, could stop them launching on DAB, but could not stop them launching it on BBC Sounds. So I suspect these services will launch whether or not the public interest test passes. So more competition on the way. And I understand, you know, that word saying, Phil saying he was rather unhappy about it.
Yes. I asked the BBC some questions this week about the announcement they made about the public interest test. And as Paul said, it looks like it's going to happen. It's just whether it happens on DAB. Now, will they get that far? I think there will be, you know, some big responses.
I mean, I just sort of think it's like the classic case of the BBC being in a situation where it's damned if it does, damned if it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because there has been this idea of, you know, we are not catering for audiences who are not happy with the direction that Radio 2's taken. So the BBC makes a take to cater for those audiences, and then it's criticised for affecting the commercial market that's built up in that time. So I guess there is going to be this to and fro about it. I mean, I would say that what I find interesting about Radio 1 Dance and Radio 1 Relax, which are the existing stations, is that it's not new content. It's essentially just spinning the stuff that's on late at night or on Sundays throughout the rest of the week. So I know that with that long announcement that was in there last week about how much new content there will be, but you sort of wonder about how much it is just going to be repackaged and whether that matters, whether viewers are just listeners are just happy archive content.
They published a bit more information this week, including budgets, and they're sort of saying they're going to spend about £3 million across the four stations, which isn't, in BBC terms, a lot of money. And also the new Radio 1 spin-off, so not Dance, the other one, I think they've only budgeted £120,000 a year for, which...
Well, that's tiny.
It's not big. And you read it all, and I feel like someone pointed this out this week, that it looked like the Radio 1 spin-off was going to be Relax, and then at the last minute changed to something else.
Right.
So I think there's more to come out of all of this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that you know, pay TV has been doing what you described for years, and it does generally produce incremental increases in reach and share. I think what's interesting about this is that radio generally produces very little unique reach to the BBC. So the BBC's argument that they need these services to reach people is actually erroneous. What it would do is increase the hours consumed of the BBC by those audiences, because they're already consuming BBC television and BBC online services. So they don't need it for universality, which underpins the license fee. So for that reason, I think the argument is a bit weak. However, you know, they're basically doing what the commercial radio sector has been doing. They're creating all these different segments, and they're going to get incremental value for incremental spend. I suspect it's going to go through.
Well, we will keep an eye on it on the show. Congratulations to Paul. You win. You have to go and find...
I think it's 1.5 each. I really feel guilty about that now. I feel bad now.
No. I think you have one, because as a prize, you've got to go and find the Hollywood star who can play me in the Netflix documentary spin-off of the Media Podcast.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm thinking about that already. Maybe Ewan McGregor?
Yeah, it'd be good. More thoughts later. Thank you both. How can people keep up with your work, Scott?
Just on ScottyGB on Twitter/X and on Threads and various other places. And of course on 5Live, where I'm there every Monday.
And Paul, people can see you in person soon, can't they? Radio Days Europe.
Radio Days Europe in Europe next month. I'll be on stage putting the glue between all the wonderful people, and you'll be there too, Matt. And if not that, on LinkedIn.
Lovely. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if you have a podcast in you, why not check out the London Podcast Studios? Because the London Podcast Studios is where we record our show. And they're offering 25% off your first booking when you use the code MEDIAPOD. Just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off with the code MEDIAPOD. If you're new to the show, why not hit follow or maybe leave us a review? In fact, please go and leave us a review. I would like some nice ones on Apple, please. Alternatively, if you go to podfollow.com/themediapodcast, that sends people to be able to listen really easily. And if you have first-hand experiences of any of the stories we've talked about, you don't need to talk to a counsellor. You can put a note in Spotify. There's a comments box. We love hearing what you think. My name is Matt Deegan. The producers were Ollie Pitt and Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you next week.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.